Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Tuesday, August 18th, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
So, Kevin, for generations, there was a pretty clear picture of what becoming a successful adult in America looked like. You grew up, you got a job, or you went to college, and eventually you got out of your parents' house. Mm-hmm. And if you came back, well, we even invented a phrase for that. It was called failure to launch.
Saw that movie?
Yeah, I saw that movie too. But what if the failure isn't the young adult moving home? What if it's an economy where rent, groceries, childcare, and home ownership have become increasingly difficult to afford alone? And what if there's something else we've got wrong? Maybe the idea that becoming an adult means needing other people less. So multi-generational living is on the rise in America. In fact, nearly a third of adults under age 35 and half under 30 live at home with parents. And so today we're asking, is moving back home really moving backward? In the age of isolation, could multi-generational living be an answer? And we've got two great guests who have thought a lot about this topic. They've also lived it. And of course, we'd love to hear from you. If you've moved back in with your parents, or if you're a parent sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. What has it been like? Do y'all have chores? What happens when somebody has a date or, you know, a romantic evening? We'd love to hear how you worked everything out. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on Facebook or YouTube, you can leave those experiences in the live chat. I mean,
it taps into a real trend, Cherry.
Yeah.
And especially that seems to have taken off after the pandemic. And with obviously what everything that's been happening in the housing market, you understand how hard it is for many people. And so it's a real reexamination of what it means to mature through certain milestones in life. And I think it's going to be a fascinating conversation today.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, no more. It's not the slacker thing, because people are many of these folks are fully employed, and it's just hard out here. So we're going to talk about that. Again, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. And like always, Kevin, we have our trio of local news stories.
Yeah, story number one. Philadelphia mm-hmm. police are searching for a man wearing a Chucky mask who has been terrorizing people in the early morning hours near City Hall. Officers released video footage yesterday and detailed an encounter where a masked man approached a jogger last Wednesday morning around 5:15 a.m., and he ran up to the woman holding his cell phone and asking her if she was, quote, ready to die. Extremely frightening scene with the woman screaming for help, the attacker running off into the suburban station concourse. Police believe the suspect is between 16 and 20 years old. Our news partners at 6ABC caught up with another woman who says she had an interaction with this masked man just before this scene with the jogger. This woman is named Tamika, and she says she kicked him in the chest and that something seemed very off about the attacker.
So then I turned around, I started yelling at him, don't follow me, you know, screaming at him. And at that point, I put up my hands as if I was going to fight. I blocked my face, made sure that my center line was protected. And then he also started to put his hands up, but I could tell that he had never been in a fight before.
So the suspect is facing charges including terroristic threats, harassment, simple assault, and intimidation. Mm. Anyone with tips is asked to contact Philadelphia police. But Cherry, I mean, just a very unnerving story in the heart of our city. Just disturbing image and disturbing scenes. And hopefully the police can find this person quickly.
Yeah, and the police has said in one of the press conferences that I saw that they thought this guy might have been recording these interactions because he had his cell phone out the entire time. And, you know, I don't recommend what Tamika did, sort of standing her ground, because it could have gone any way. Yeah. But, you know, she was able to best him a little bit. And, you know, but I hope he stops, because I think about this. This is Philadelphia. A lot of people are licensed to carry. Mm-hmm. You can't terrorize people in this way, because it could go south really, really quickly. So hopefully the police will identify this suspect and this, you know, these terror incidents will stop.
Yeah. Story number two, Cherry.
Story number two. There is a war of words going on in Pennsylvania's first congressional district race. Democrat Bob Harvey has challenged incumbent Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick to a duel. four debates. Shout out to the Philadelphia Inquirer for documenting this back and forth. And so let me just break it down. So Harvey's campaign challenged Fitzpatrick to four debates. The Inky reached out to Fitzpatrick's campaign, which said, we'll up you. They countered by saying they'll do 10 debates, but only if Harvey releases files related to an FBI investigation that Fitzpatrick and his supporters claim focuses on Harvey. Harvey's campaign manager says there are no such files, and Fitzpatrick knows that. He says that, you know, he's never been under investigation. So, according to the Inquirer, the Democrat has filed a defamation lawsuit against a pro-Fitzpatrick PAC that has made claims around this FBI investigation. So, to make a long story short, this has led to a lot of back and forth and harsh words between the two candidates and their campaigns. Harvey claims that Fitzpatrick has refused to answer questions here at home and has nothing to show for his 10 years in Congress. And of course, Fitzpatrick's basically doubling down on this FBI investigation. So right now, the two sides are at a stalemate. And I have to say, this is not good for voters because, you know, it's been years since the residents of the first district have had a chance to witness a debate or to hear from candidates on either side in that kind of way. Fitzpatrick did not debate his challenger back in 2024. And according to reporting, the last time Fitzpatrick announced an in-person public town hall was back in 2017.
Interesting. It's difficult to unwind in this case, but I think we should just mention, like, what's happening here is the FBI at some point did a probe into the Pennsbury School District, mm-hmm. and it seems at another point interviewed some people related to Falls Township and Pennsbury. Now, Bob Harvey was a Falls Township supervisor, and he testified before a grand jury in specifically that Pennsbury School District case. So he testified in a case, it seems, against something that was happening related to political donations and contracts in Pennsbury School District. There was no wrongdoing allegation leveled against Bob Harvey, but the fact that there's just murkiness in what did he testify about and what's going on in this case, Fitzpatrick seems to be seizing on that as an opportunity to maybe draw some scrutiny against Harvey, which Harvey says isn't warranted. So that's kind of what's happening in this case.
But you're wondering why this is tied to whether or not there's a debate.
Right. So, yeah, I don't know what to say about that other than we here at WHYY in Studio 2 have been trying to book a debate with Bob Harvey and Brian Fitzpatrick ourselves. We haven't gotten anywhere yet on that. We are very open to them being on the show, whether or not they're debating back and forth, whether or not we do 25 minutes with one candidate, 25 minutes with the other candidate. We're open to that. We're working on that. So if anybody in those campaigns is listening, we are ready to take that phone call.
Yeah. And I think the voters deserve to hear from both candidates in this district race. So third story.
Yeah. Story number three, Cherry. Do you think we need a museum centered on the worst, most stereotypical characteristics of Philadelphians? Do you enjoy museums that are free?
I like free museums. I'm
and
from
D.C. Do you want to go to a museum that's 300 square feet of space in a guy's Fishtown apartment?
That seems a bit small.
Well, the Museum of the Philadelphian is coming next month with a claim of being an unapologetic micro museum about Philadelphia's people, and specifically leaning into the booing, battery throwing, hitchbot destroying side of city residents. The guy behind it is Brian Adolph, and he tells Philly Mag that, quote, it's about the personality and the attitude, but really at its heart, it's a love letter to the city and the people of the city. He plans on opening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, starting in late September. Cherry, are you going to be, getting your name on the list for opening weekend here?
I don't know. I mean, some examples of exhibits, by the way, I want to say that, a dismembered and decapitated hitchbot, Brian says he's going to give the full story because Philadelphians did offer to fix hitchbot.
Right, right.
And they offered to raise money for hitchbot. So, you know, there is a little bow there.
My gut here is like, I kind of think the Philadelphians are mean. The trope is tired at this point. Like, it's just become such a stereotype, and there's so many counterexamples. But for some reason, we still love it, even though we hate it, and we keep perpetuating it, even though there's plenty of other examples. So I do like, with this museum, he does seem to be saying he's going to call out the positives
as well. And so I would nominate that Tamika's boot.
Ooh.
That kicked... that kicked, the Chucky mask wearing guy in the chest.
Yeah.
That to me, that's a hero. There, we have a lot of Philadelphia heroes.
That's true.
And I think that they should be included in the Museum of the Philadelphia.
You should start not a all, Philadelphia Heroes
you know,
Museum.
It should always
Cherry,
be.
You should call it the Good Souls Museum.
I know. I feel like there's so many good things that we could be highlighting. Tough, because that toughness has a good side. You know, Philadelphians aren't nice, but they are kind.
Right. We don't need another museum about throwing snowballs at Santa Claus and, yeah. and batteries.
But
and
it
stuff.
Says a lot Let's that it's only 300 square feet.
Right.
That, I mean, it's going to be very small. So there's that
yes.
part. 300 square foot. That's how much that part fits into a museum. And so coming up, we're going to be talking about multi-generational living. Are you a parent living with adult children? Are you a child who had to move back home as an adult? 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org to share your experiences. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. More young adults are living with mom and dad than ever before. Nearly half of 18 to 30-year-olds. Whether it's the uncertain job market or sky-high housing costs, an increasing number of adult children, they're sharing their roof, a roof with their parents. And living with your folks, it used to invite some snickering, right? Little stigma, proof that you couldn't hack it on your own. But given today's economy and the shrinking opportunities for young people, that stigma is fading. So today we're talking about the pros and cons of living with your folks as an adult. Is multi-generational living going mainstream? What does it say about our modern society? And what's the secret to peaceful cohabitation? And as always, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. If you've moved back in with your parents or are a parent who is sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. What's it like to live with your parents again? And for parents, what's it like to live with your adult children? Who does what chores? We'd love to hear the nitty gritty a little bit. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube folks, you can comment in the live chat. And we have two great guests who have experienced both sides of this trend as an adult and as a parent. And let me introduce them. We have Samantha Paige Rosen. She's a writer with the and the author of Living Together, Reimagining Community in the Age of Disconnection. And we also have Julie Lithcott-Hames, the author of How to Raise an Adult and the forthcoming book, The Not-So-Empty Nest, A How-To Guide for Parents and Adult Children Living Together. Samantha and Julie, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And hello, can you hear me, Julie?
It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me, Cherry.
Yes. And so I wanted to sort of start the conversation because both of you have experience sort of on both sides of this, living with adult parents, maybe even having to bring in someone who is an adult into the home. And so I want to sort of start with where you both realize that this was not just a personal thing, that this was becoming a nationwide trend. When was the moment, and I'll start with you, Julie, that you realize, okay, it's not just me. This is happening all over.
Yeah. So in March of 2020, as was the case for many families, my young adult children came back home. My eldest was 20. He had just been dealing with some mental health issues, left college, and was kind of really down and out when the pandemic hit. And so he came home, which was quite natural, but then he stayed. And even as he began to get well in terms of his mental health and he got a full-time job and the world was starting to open up, our son showed no signs of leaving. And here I am, the expert of this parenting book, How to Raise an Adult, the premise of which is you got to be independent. The underpinning of which was you got to be up or out of your parents' home by 18 or 21. And so I felt like a failure. Not just my son was failing, but I, this parenting author, was failing. So I grew curious about, well, why is this happening? Is it only happening in my house? And of course, the answer was no. My news feed was continually filled with stories of young adults who either never left or returned home and were staying. And I began to appreciate, as I put two and two together, hey, whether it's mental health issues, whether it's the cost of living, whether you're just really relationally close and you like each other in terms of the parents of millennials and the parents of Gen Zs being closer to them relationally than we Gen Xers were to our parents, it makes sense for all kinds of reasons. So it was that personal sort of sense of failure that got me curious and made me realize, no, it's happening all over. Let's figure out how we can get people to be good at it.
Yeah. And so, Samantha, you've been writing about communal living and from a broader context, but you moved back in with your parents at one point. When did you realize it wasn't just you? This was a bigger issue and it was happening with a lot of people.
Yeah. So it was a couple years into living with my parents. I moved back in with them in 2019. It was maybe 9 months before COVID hit. And I didn't know anyone else who, my age, 29 years old, who was living with their parents. For me, it was due to kind of burnout and stress from a job. And my parents were like, come home. But I would say maybe 6 months into COVID times, I started to see that people were uprooting their lives to move back in with their parents or aunts, uncles, grandparents, whether it was due to losing their jobs or just being incredibly isolated.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think from there, as the housing market continued to get more and more expensive, we've just seen more and more of it. And I think to me, this feels like proof that, you know, life's transitions aren't necessarily a failure in the way that we've been taught that they are, but rather, you know, sometimes there is an ebb and flow that family support for long or short term can be helpful for. I didn't want to move out of my parents' home. I stayed for 6 years. And now we live across the street from each other. And that support continues to be really helpful, even when positive things happen. Like, I launched my book. It was incredibly busy. And I needed support.
And that makes me wonder. And by the way, I want to read a quick comment. Natasha on Facebook says, I allowed my grown children to stay at home in order to save, make mistakes, and grow into adulthood. Each of them are successful in their careers and live on their own. I didn't have this option due to being in the foster care system. So Natasha gave her kids something she didn't necessarily have when she was growing into being a young adult. And so I want to ask you this, Julie. How did we get here to this place where there was this stigma? Because now we're talking about erasing the stigma. And both of you have had experiences on the opposite sides of having to bring a kid home, going home. It seems like to me, communal living near family, it used to be the way. It seemed like it was a way, and it was the way, and it is the way in a lot of cultures around the world.
That's right. That's right. Cherry, you just hit the nail on the head. It's the way humans have always lived since the beginning of humankind. It only recently fell out of favor in the United States post-World War II. So from about the late 1940s until COVID, it was uncommon in the U.S. for adult children to be living at home in the mainstream. But let me caveat that in many communities, African-American communities, Latino communities, immigrant communities, it has never not been the norm to live at home. But what we're seeing now is in the mainstream. We're looking at these large numbers, you know, 50% of 18 to 30 year olds are living at home now. Right. So what has changed? The point is, when did we stop living at home and why? And here's what happened. Post-World War II, the GIs came home from winning World War II. The government handed them the GI Bill, said, go get your higher education. It was heavily subsidized. It was sort of really easy to go get further training and education. The local governments were building suburbs across America. This concept of zoning, single family homes were being built. They were neighborhoods were created. They were very inexpensive. And the minimum wage in that era, believe it or not, everybody, just hold your breath. Minimum wage supported a man, his wife, and their child. Very gendered language appropriate to the time. But the point is, your minimum wage job meant you could afford a freaking house because the government was making all of this possible.
Those
were
the
days. And
really,
the capitalist engine was saying, hey, young adult, get out there. You don't need to live at home. Be independent. Move out. Get your own house. Buy your own refrigerator. Buy your own washing machine. Begin to be a consumer in this capitalist economy as an individual. Mm. So it drove that capitalist engine. Conditions were very good. So when grandpa today says, when I was your age, I owned a house and had a, you know, it's like, Grandpa, yeah, things have changed. We have failed to create the macroeconomic conditions that would allow people to get up and out of their parents' home and get their own place. It is no longer possible because wages and salaries are here and the cost of living is here, if not here. You're not supposed to spend more than 30-40% of your wages or salaries on your housing. So what do you do when society has failed to build enough housing such that you can't enter the market?
Yeah.
You live at home and it isn't failure.
Yeah, it isn't failure. By the way, if you move back with your parents or a parent sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. What's it like to live with your parents again? And for parents, what's it like to live with your adult children? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTube viewers, you can comment in the live chat. Let me read a couple comments. Charito on Facebook says, I have 2 out of my 5 kids living at home. One of them is 26 years old and he's a teacher. The second is 29 years old and she's a radiologist. She also has a baby girl. I have no problem with them staying home and building a strong financial foundation. Everything is very expensive nowadays, and we all are collaborating at home. We have a caller, Anita from Conshohocken, on the line. Anita, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
Hi.
Hi.
My comment is families need to stick together. My son and his 2 daughters had moved in a while ago. He is now married and moved to Ohio, but we still have one of his daughters with us. She's been with us for 12 years. She works 2 jobs and can't afford an apartment. Living in Conshohocken is beyond anyone's means at this point. But it is good to have her here and knowing that she's okay and being taken care of.
Yeah, thank you. Anita from Conshohocken on the line. Sharing her story. I mean, Samantha, love to hear your reaction to that. And you moved in with your parents. Like you said, you burn out. Tell us a little bit about that story as you react with what Anita had to say. She loves having, you know, the daughter there. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's so sweet to hear, Anita. When I moved back in with my parents, I had been out of the house since I was 18. I went to college, then, you know, always had pretty much a job. And I had a particular series of jobs that just were incredibly exhausting and made it really stressful and difficult in a mental sense and even a physical sense with chronic pain that I think had some to do with the mental strain to even, you know, do what I needed to do in my household, to do all the chores by yourself and always cook by yourself. And so I think in addition to my parents, being kind enough and having the space and the means enough to tell me to, okay, you know, it's time to chuck that job. It's not serving you. Come home. I think that, you know, the collaboration on things like chores, cooking, cleaning is incredible. I think it was about $20,000 of student loans left when I moved in with my parents. And, you know, having some financial relief not only allowed me to get well, figure out what I wanted to do for work, which I very quickly did. Within 3 months, I'd started my own business because I was well and motivated and felt, you know, somewhat cared for. But I was able to pay off my student loans so much faster and eventually save for the townhouse that I now was able to buy in this crazy housing market.
And I just love that. And so, you know, Julie, I think about there's a difference between the story that you hear Samantha telling, the story of your son Avery moving home. And I think I got your son's name right.
That's actually my daughter. My son is Sawyer.
Sawyer, your son who moved home, Sawyer. And you think about, because there's this the stigma, the idea of who lives at home, you know, and I want you to peel that back because there's a difference between, you know, an adult child who decides to move home because for whatever reason, they're working, they're doing all the things, they're helping out. And the other child that people think, oh, they're a slacker, they can't hack it, they're right. failing to launch. Can you help us right. build that distinction and walk us through how you even shifted your own mindset as someone who thought you failed when yeah. your son moved home?
Yeah. So I've gone from you're a failure if you're living in your parents' home. I was really of that mindset to being an adult isn't about where you live. It's about how you behave. And so the question is, when that adult child, as I call them, I try not to say young adult because some are 32, you know, that adult child is living with parents or grandparents, are they behaving their age or are they behaving like a 15-year-old or like an 11-year-old? This gets to the issue of how is the work of the household distributed? Mm-hmm. This is a lifestyle that comes with all kinds of blessings.
Yeah.
My shift really happened when my son got well, my son got work. We began talking to him about why his room was so messy and could he help out more with chores. We gained confidence. We didn't know what role a parent was supposed to play in the life of an adult child because none of this was scripted for us, right? Those of us who are Gen X and boomers, we thought you just left home. We didn't know yeah. how to parent someone who came back. So we were figuring out through family therapy, but we began to sort out, you know, how to have the tough conversations and also not to behave from a place of my house, my rules. I'm the parent. I'm in charge. Right. That doesn't work. If it worked when they were 0 to 18, that's one thing. But now that they're adults, no adult wants to be told what to do like they're in the military when it's their house. So you got to get to a place where you're not levying your power that comes with your age and stage as a parent, but rather how can we foster mutual respect? We all matter. We're all at a different age and stage. How can we contribute equitably, not the same amount if some of mm-hmm. us have more resources than others, but what are you doing to have skin in the game so you feel you are cooperating in the running of this house from groceries to chores to paying some of the yeah. bills? Now, how decisions get made. We're all adults here is kind of the new mantra. How can we respect one another? We have a mantra in our house, which is we cannot not talk about things. We got to talk about things. And talking about the little things on a regular basis makes it easier to talk about the harder yeah. things when they arise. And then intentional rituals to strengthen your relationships help make all of the tough conversations easier because you're getting to know each other better and you're getting to develop a deeper bond.
I love that. And by the way, if you have an experience you'd like to share, the number to call 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our YouTube and Facebookers, you can put those experiences in the live chat. Again, if you've moved in back in with your parents or you're a parent sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. I'm going to bring in another caller. We have Bill from West Grove on the line. Bill, you're on Studio 2. What's your experience?
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I moved back in with my parents out of college. And then again, about 6 years later, when I was actually married, my wife and I moved in. Don't need to go into the reasons for that. But what happened, as your guest was saying, was navigating a new adult relationship with my parents. I now have my son was teaching in Spain for a couple years. He's landed back with us and kind of going through that same thing of renegotiating that adult relationship. And added on to that, I now have a 95-year-old mother that I'm the primary caregiver for. And I really believe it's a joy taking care of her. And it was that foundation that we formed as when I was a young adult living with her that has helped me navigate that new relationship as she's aged. Both my older brothers say, I don't know how you do it. And I say, I love it. And again, I really think it was that ability to live together at that stage and become adult friends as well as, you know, parent-child.
And Bill, quick follow-up to you. I mean, when did you realize that, you know, because I think sometimes when you're a child and even when you become an adult, you look at your parents, you still see them as mom or dad. When did you start seeing them? What was the moment that you think, oh, wow, I see my mom or my dad as a fully formed person outside of their parental, you know, connection to me?
Yeah, that's a great question. And as I said, I ended up living with them right out of college. And then again, you know, my wife and I were in a job transition period and lived with them for a bit. And I think it was at that point where, you know, I'm married and I'm living with them and realizing they're dealing with a marital relationship, even though I've been living a long time together, that they're still got friction in there and they're dealing with that. And we're dealing with it, you know, with my wife. And it was suddenly like, we're just adult people trying to figure this all out.
Yeah. Respect. Thank you so much, Bill from Westgrove. Samantha, you know, when was the moment that you're living with your parents? You had lived there and then you moved out for years, for a decade plus. You were living on your own. And was it like sort of tricky that they, when you came back, was it like, you know, you're still Samantha, our child? And then, and how did you sort of build that boundary and stand the ground and create that adult relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that, you know, Bill and Julie and I are all alluding to the fact that this has to be really intentional and you have to see all the people in the household as fully formed people. I think that for me, I was lucky in that I had lived with my parents for like, you know, summers in grad school. Mm-hmm. So, you know, from 1 month to 2 months at a time. And we did get along as friends. And so there was never a statement at any point before I moved in long term or during where we were like, okay, we are now friends.
it just kind of formed.
You are person, I am person. But I think that we had kind of a foundation of, you know, yes, they are my parents and I am their child. And they like being parental. But we also saw each other as friends each time I was able to come back, and they kind of saw me in my development and I saw them in theirs becoming empty nesters. I have two younger sisters, but I got to see them in different iterations as I came back for a week or weeks at a time. And so that felt a little bit more organic. But, you know, it doesn't mean that there wasn't friction.
Yeah.
And that's something that I have all throughout my book is like, this is absolutely not a case for communal living is rosy all the time. Mm-hmm. It's more like, these are the realities, these are the frictions, and what do we have to do to work through those? Because the truth is that many of us are going to be in situations, especially like Bill's, where, you know, you have an aging parent, younger kids, you're all living together, and how are you intentional and communicative around that so that it can be a nice experience that everyone can look back on, even if it also has challenges.
Yeah. And by the way, we have another Julie on the line who wrote in, who says, I'm an adult under 35 and living with my mom has been completely necessary. Beyond the financial benefits, we've been able to support each other through serious health situations. Plus, since we're in the same field, I get to learn from my mom and collaborate with her on professional projects. We're coming up on a break pretty soon, Julie, but I'd love to get your take sort of from the parents' perspective when you started really seeing your son Sawyer, you know, and he actually stepped up and helped you through a very trying time with your own parents.
Yeah, thank you for that. And shout out to Bill and to Julie for, you know, sort of bringing into the conversation what it's like when there are caregiving needs involved. That's certainly what shifted things for us. My mother, with whom my partner and I have owned a home for 25 years, so I was that young 30-something who bought a house with my mother. That's a different, you know, it's a related story and gives me a different perspective on things. But anyway, she was aging, she was ill, she had cancer and dementia. And as Sawyer was moving from, you know, mental health struggles, unemployed, can't get off the couch, to addressing those things with our support, my mother's health was diminishing. As he was getting well, she was declining, and we all lived together. And we got to a point where he became one of her regular caregivers. And caregiving, as everyone knows, is scary and hard and sad. And at the same time, my partner and I were going through our own financial challenges. So our son had the full-time job and the benefits and the paycheck. And we were struggling and grandma was dying. And I looked at him and I said, I don't know how we'd be doing any of this without you. And I think that's the moment I knew. My son is a full-fledged adult. We all live together. And thank goodness he's here, because his presence is bringing us untold blessings and benefits. Truly a bonus to have him back in the house.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing. And I'd love to, we're going to talk about, we're going coming up on a break, and on the other side of the break, we're going to dig into the pros and cons of this type of communal living, because there's a lot of beauty that comes from the kids, the adult children get, also the parents get, and it's multi-generational living can be very beautiful. We'll also talk about some of the rules on how people navigate some of the stickier situations. And again, we'd love to hear from you. If you're an adult who had to move back home with parents, or a parent that's sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. We have a caller on the line. We have a bunch of comments we're going to get to. This is Studio 2. We'll see you on the other side of this break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg. So today we're talking about the record number of adult children moving back in with their parents and the economic conditions that are driving this trend. But before we get back to that conversation, I want to shout out a live broadcast event that we have coming up next week. The Philadelphia International Classic, or Cycling Classic, is back after a decade hiatus. And Studio 2, guess what? We will be broadcasting from the course ahead of race weekend. We'll be in Manayunk at Love City Brewing on Thursday, August 27th. And if you want to be in our live audience from noon to 1 p.m. that day, you can register now at whyy.org/event. Again, whyy.org/event. And everyone who comes, you get a beer on us. You might want to be there. I hope to see you there again Thursday, August 27th. Now let me reintroduce our guests. We have Samantha Page Rosen, writer and author of Living Together, Reimagining Community in the Age of Disconnection, and Julie Lythcott-Hames, author of How to Raise an Adult and the forthcoming book, The Not So Empty Nest, a how-to guide for parents and adult children living together. And of course, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Our question of the day, once again, is if you've moved back in with your parents or you're a parent sharing a home with an adult child, we'd love to hear your experience. What's it like to live with your parents again? And for parents, what's it like to live with your adult children? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTubers, you can put your comments in the live chat. Let's bring in another caller. We have Dot from Southampton on the line. Dot, you're on Studio 2. What's your experience?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. 3 years ago, our daughter was pregnant with twins, number 4 and 5.
Oh, wow.
And to help them get a bigger home. And we did, and my husband and I, then she asked us to build an addition on if we were interested in that. So that's what we did. So we were there for a year before we built the addition. And now we help out with the children, which we love. And the game plan is we're in our 70s, so they will help us as we age. We had my parents when the house we built, so my daughter knew nothing else than living with multi-generational living. Yeah. Anyway, it's a good thing.
Yeah.
And it works. It works.
Well, thank
you. You have to have your mouth closed at times.
Sometimes it's better not to say it. Yes, Dot from Southampton talking about it. And, Samantha, it's not lost on me that you used the time to really pay off debt and to save up to buy the house right across the street. And so can you talk? I would love to hear both of you talk about some of the pros and cons of this type of living situation, because if done right, having that support from your mom or dad can really set you up for a good, solid life, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Cherry. When I graduated from college, I moved 3,000 miles away and had lived in apartments ever since. So I had not saved up the kind of money that that frankly is needed to buy or, you know, buy a home or have, you know, a really substantial savings, despite always being independent, always working.
Mm-hmm.
And so the financial benefits were very real of living with my parents. They wouldn't let me pay rent at all, but I would try and pay, you know, some incidentals. But even if you are paying rent and splitting the cost. I think that it is still cheaper. Sharing household goods is cheaper, and that's something we do now, even living across the street. For me, I live alone now, and I cannot eat all my food. Like, it will go bad. And so I just said in an interview, like, a shared bag of carrots isn't going to fix the societal ills that we have necessarily. But food waste does go down. And I'm always doing that with my parents back and forth. You and I were just talking about, again, in the food category, having a home cooked meal
that you did not prepare,
however many days a week that happens, is incredible. And for me, you know, even just the casual moments with my parents, the kind of mundane time, the company that I had, you know, being able to turn to someone and say, hey, you just want to watch this thing on TV. You know, we don't even have to talk, but I'm not alone, right?
Yeah.
Or even for whatever reason, this always happened where we would be cleaning up from dinner and somehow like my dad would be humming and then I would be singing. And like, sure, I can sing alone and do my dishes when I'm by myself, but I don't. And there is something nice about that interdependence, you know, and mundane social time that you don't have to plan for and you don't have to schedule or negotiate.
And it's almost like, and Julie, you can chime in here, because it's almost like it's a cure to the isolation, you know, epidemic so many people are suffering from. Multi-generational living is a cure to that.
100%. So remember, everybody, this is how humans have always lived. We are in this technological moment where we're globally connected, yet disconnected from the people in our neighborhoods and families often. And so coming back to the house and living together is a return to what has always been the strongest structure supporting human beings and thriving. I'll add to the pros, the financial, whether it's current bills or long-term planning, the pros around connection, community, combating loneliness, as we've said. I would call it the mutuality of care. Samantha has done a great job of sharing with us what that's been like for her. Whether somebody needs childcare help, somebody is an elder who needs support, someone is chronically ill, or just short-term circumstances needing care, Samantha used the word interdependence. And that's really the moment we're trying to get to. It's not, I'm independent, I don't need people. It's like, no, I'm independent, meaning I'm capable of doing a lot, but I'm also here to support you. And I know you're here to support me. And that's when multi-generational living really hums or sings, as is the case with Samantha's family. In our family, we howled. This is going to sound crazy, but we have this ritual of like, you walk into the house and you howl like a wolf, like, oh, like I'm home. And you listen. Oh, no, it's crazy. But I did this because I read somewhere the wolves aren't howling at the moon. They're howling for each other. And when I heard that, I got chills. I was like, my God, where are my peeps? Where are my wolves? When I come into my house and I howl and my son or husband howls back, I'm like, I belong. I'm not alone on this spinning marble. The cons are, privacy. Yeah. Let's just get down to brass tacks.
Let's get to
privacy.
It.
Privacy. If you're an adult of a certain age and you're an empty nest and you're still in love with your partner and your kids are gone and then they move back, you're like, wait a minute.
Because
some alone time finally. We all need privacy for various reasons. And negotiating that and being adult enough to talk about that is, I think, an important component of this.
Because if you're, and it's both sides, because if you're, you know, you still got it going on with the partner, you know, and you got the kids come back, you know, that alone time, that romantic time could be hampered by having an adult child. Also, if you're an adult child dating, how do you navigate that? Do y'all put like the scarf on the doorknob? Like what, what are the rules of this? Samantha, Julie, break it down.
Well, go ahead, Samantha.
It sounds like Julie maybe had more intentional conversations with her children than my parents had with me about their needs. But I will say that, you know, from my perspective, I made sure that I was like out and about on weekend nights. You know, my parents didn't want to tell me to go away. I don't know what transpired while I was gone.
Did they pump up the music?
I don't know what transpired, but I definitely did make sure that I was not always around. And I was like, let me just give them there. They can choose what to do with it. I'm going to give them their space, especially on weekend nights. And for me, I did date. I would go out on dates. My parents, they were a little bit nosier than I liked.
Mm-hmm.
Because every first date is like so promising. And I was like, guys, it's not that promising. Let me just go on this date. You don't need to know their name. Let me out. I kind of had to put a damper on the conversation around it. I did not bring people back to my house with my parents. But I have friends. I have a friend who lives with her parents. She's in her late 20s. She's been doing it ever since she graduated from college. And she just told me that, you know, her mom goes away for the weekend. That's when the partner gets to come over. And so I think I'd be really curious to hear about some of Julie's more direct conversations. But at the very least, I think there was like respectful shuffling of space that allowed for things to be
you,
fine
you guys
for 6 years.
Were very polite. Yeah, okay. I'm just going to go away.
You're polite. Well, I would have
been
more direct.
Y'all holding a lot of hands in the kitchen. So I'm going right. to. I'm going to disappear. Like, that's what it is. So what did you do, Julie?
I love the polite conversation approach. I tell you what, we had to get more direct because we realized we felt like we were sneaking around and we were like teenagers who weren't supposed to. We're like, this is our
but
house.
That could make it cool know. Though, but go ahead.
It could, but you're like, but when you're like, is he gone? Is it time?
Let's do it.
Like,
yeah.
You know, it's not always, you know, you can't always seize those moments, even if you want to. It just, so we decided we had to be a little bit more direct without being overtly blatant, because he doesn't want us to be blatant, right? So we got to this middle space of like, hey, let us know. Are you going out tonight? Let us know. When will you be home? Because we'd like the house. And we kind of leave it at that. We'd like the house, or what are your plans? Or we need some time. And our son, who's a, you know, Gen Z, instantly is like, thank you for asking for what you need. We're like, okay. You know, like, he knows what
he's
we're
like,
saying. And
it's clicking.
Like, I
got it.
And thank you for not saying to, no TMI here. You said just enough. So I know he's very, we're mutually respectful of the fact that we're all adults trying to cohabitate under this one roof. And similarly, when he has friends over, when he has stuff going on, we're like, you know, we'll get out of your way. We'll get out of your hair.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's bring in another caller. We're going to bring Samantha from Doylestown. And Samantha, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
So I feel like I have a unique perspective on multi-generational living. It's
okay.
How I grew up. My mom and grandmother purchased a house together in the 90s, and otherwise it's not a situation my mom would have been able to find herself in, being a homeowner and, you know, building that generational wealth.
Mm-hmm.
She wouldn't have been able to do that without that. And then we intentionally looked for a house and bought a house with her in 2017, my husband and I, and we have two young kids. We all live together now, and I really couldn't imagine balancing being a working parent with everything else without my mom there as support, living there, being there every day for all of it.
And so, Samantha, you know, I got to ask you, how do you navigate the need for privacy? Because you're married in there. Like, are you direct? Do you put the scarf on the doorknob? How do you guys work this out, Samantha?
So we are lucky enough to have a good separation between our bedrooms and our private living spaces. So I think that's mostly how we navigate it. Just having that like little literal physical space between where our bedroom is located and where she sleeps at night. It's a fact of life.
Yeah.
We try not to make it awkward and just be open and honest about it and be respectful, of course. Like, we're not, you know.
Yeah, everybody's
using
adults.
The common space for these activities. But
Well, thank you.
Again, being respectful and honest. Yep.
Thank you so much. That's Samantha from Doylestown. So we only have a couple more minutes, but I would love to get some advice on boundary setting, you know, and just, you know, your selling point for this no longer being a situation that has stigma, because there's a lot of pros. The big con is privacy. I'm sure there are others. But, you know, just your advice for setting boundaries and living and cohabitating in a positive way. Across generations. And Samantha, and then we'll let Julie close it out.
Sounds good. Yeah, I think I would say that, you know, your family is not necessarily going to be your perfect roommate experience. But sort of embracing that,
yeah,
and setting a good foundation for, you know, appropriately being able to talk about things like it sounds like, you know, Julie and many of the callers do. Communication is important, knowing how and when to bring up the things that feel challenging and what things to let go, I think, make yeah. for a pretty successful experience, and also kind of holding this, like, you can be an independent person and still live multi-generationally, and you can be interdependent, and those things are not mutually exclusive.
I like that.
Yeah. And that's sort of the takeaway. My selling point for this, am I supposed to sell it?
And quickly, because we, yeah.
Okay, so selling point, community, company, and shared financial benefits.
I like that. Julie, final word.
My family needed therapy, not going to lie. It was hard for us. We didn't know how to talk to our adult son. We didn't know what to ask of him. So we got family therapy. I highly recommend it for people who are like, this all sounds like everyone's doing great. My family is struggling. I get you. It's hard. That's why I wrote this book, The Not So Empty Nest. In my book, I'm trying to offer on the page sort of a therapy light, which basically boils down to, you got to talk regularly about all the things. Yeah. I recommend family meetings approximately once a week. You set aside time. I create a structure in the book for how to have those meetings. This is where you talk about anything from chores to, you know, needing private time or what have you. And then focus on rituals together, gardening, baking, going for walks, getting to know each other better.
And we got
to
leave it there.
Yeah.
And we got to leave it there. We got to leave it there. That is the voice of Julie Lithcott Haynes, author of How to Raise an Adult, and the forthcoming book, The Not So Empty Nest, A How-To Guide for Parents and Adult Children Living Together. And we also heard from Samantha Paige Rosen, writer and author of Living Together, Reimagining Community and the Age of Disconnection. Thank you both for being on Studio 2. And also, thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams, Al Banks, and Mike Schiffler, engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. I'm Cherry Gregg. Thanks so much for listening.